Good morning. This backdrop that I have here for today's talk is going to stay out there most of the time. This is Mount Tabor. It's at the eastern end of the Jezreel Valley in northern Israel. This particular picture is a very early color photograph from the 19th century. It looks a little different now. It's got a town around the base, but I thought we'd stick with the 19th century version simply because I think that probably looks a bit more like it was at the time this psalm was written. Now, this is a place of memory for the people of God. The Jezreel Valley was the site of a number of very significant events in the history of the Old Testament. And it was here, according to Judges 4, that Barak, instructed by the prophetess Deborah, gathered his troops before they took on the army of Jabin, who was led by the general Sisera. The story has a very gory ending. You can read it in Judges 4 and 5. But the key thing for our purposes is if you get to the end of Judges 4, it tells us this. On that day, God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, before the Israelites. This was a place associated for the people of Israel with divine rescue. In the same neighborhood, actually, the events to do with Gideon took place. Now, in our psalm, it's mentioned the defeat of Jabin and the defeat of Sisera. It also mentions Zeba and Zalmunna and Oreb and Zeb. Now, these were those who were defeated by Gideon. Again, this is in the same locality, the Jezreel Valley. The Midianite camp on that occasion had gathered a little further south at the hill of Moreh. But again, same neck of the woods, it appears, possibly on this hill, some of Gideon's brothers were killed. So this is a place of memory, a place associated with divine rescue, divine deliverance. As the people look back, as the psalmist here looks back to the past. Now, the predicament that the psalmist talks of in this psalm shows that the days of this particular deliverance are now long in the past. And it appears, if you look at the middle, well, sort of second section of here, the people of God are surrounded again. They are under incredible pressure. This day of deliverance is past. And so what the psalmist does in Psalm 83 is he calls people's minds back to God's deliverance, which happened in the surroundings of Tabor. But now if we go back through verses 5 to 8, moving backwards in the psalm, we have this alliance which is described against God's people. In fact, the alliance isn't just against God's people. It repeatedly makes clear in the psalm that these are not just the enemies of God's people, they are the enemies of God himself. And we've got this great listing of these peoples, Edom, the Ishmaelites, Moab, the Hagrites, some of whom are quite difficult to identify now, but it's been suggested that what is going on here is a kind of a geographical circling of Israel, of the people of God, because we have enemies to the west, enemies to the north, enemies to the east, enemies to the south. The people of God are surrounded, they are besieged and beleaguered. They have formed an alliance. In fact, technically what it says there is they have made a covenant against God's people. And the psalmist's experience in the middle of this is that God is nowhere to be seen. God has gone, from the psalmist's perspective, absent without leave. God seems to have gone passive, quiet, silent. We have this threefold plea, a protest at the beginning of the psalm. God, do not remain silent. Do not turn a deaf ear. Do not stand aloof. Oh, God. Now, this is not the silence of God that people sometimes envisage, I suppose. Maybe if the experience of the quiet time where you're trying to listen out for the still small voice or whatever and listening in the silence. Part of this you hear is that there is a great racket going on. There's a cacophony, and it is the enemies of God who are shouting and raging. Well, the NIV says that they're growling, which if you look at some other translations, it's a bit more dramatic. I think growling just gives me the image of a slightly disgruntled dog going, rawr, rawr. This is rage, racket. You cannot hear anything else, and you certainly can't hear the God, because these enemies who have surrounded God's people are shouting. There is tumult, cacophony, noise. And they're standing up proudly, lifting up their heads against God's people. Where is God in all of this? Now, some people under those circumstances might lose faith and say that God has gone. And yet the psalmist, by his actions in continuing to cry out to God, shows that he has not lost faith. What he does is what Asaph does is he casts his mind back to the deliverances of God in the past and says, look, God, you have done this before. You have done this before, even through the weakest of individuals facing the most difficult of circumstances. Through Barak, who was such a wimp that he wouldn't go unless Deborah went with him. For Gideon, who, well, he was told to shrink his army. And yet, through these desperately weak people, God brought about the deliverance, and it was totally unambiguous that the deliverer was God. And so the psalmist cries out, do to our enemies now, whoever they are, do to them what you did to Jabin and Sisera. And it's actually quite difficult to nail down an exact historical situation for Psalm 83. In fact, commentators have suggested anywhere from about the 8th to 9th century BC, in the time of the monarchy, right through into the time of Nehemiah, right through even into the Maccabean crisis of the 2nd century. In fact, what we've got in the listing of people here, of nations, is, like I said, it's quite difficult to map it onto anything else you find in the Old Testament. There's an episode in 2 Chronicles 20 involving King Jehoshaphat, where there is an alliance, but it doesn't include some of these ones. So in a way, what seems to be going on here is we've got almost like a formulaic list of the enemies of God, which does mean that this psalm can quite easily be reused in all these different situations. So even if it's an 8th century psalm, it's utterly applicable in the time of Nehemiah, or in the Maccabean crisis, or in our day, where the set of the enemies of God may not include Amalek and Ammon, but are nonetheless real for that, even though they manifest in clearly very different ways. And so what the psalmist does is he recalls God's previous deliverances, and he recalls also that God is the Lord of all creation. And you see this in verses 13 through 16, where it's as though the psalmist is calling on God to exercise the lordship he has over the forces of nature, the forces of the creation, and bring about deliverance. And so in this psalm, in this plea and this protest, there is a recognition that God is the Lord, the Most High over all the earth, which is the phrase and the framing you find in the final verse here. As we think about how this kind of thing plays out for us, you know, the memories of Tabor, how does that work for us? Well, I'd like to take us on just a little journey away from Tabor, actually. The memory of Tabor, the victory of God through the agency of Barak and his army and Deborah, that is to us an encouragement and recollection. But I'd like us now to imagine we're walking just a few miles west along the Jezreel Valley. As you walk west along the Jezreel Valley, I've never been there, but I've read this in a book, okay? Okay. There is to your right, to the north, there is a steep escarpment. So we're going to go about 5 or 6 miles as the crow flies from Mount Tabor, walking, presumably this is up to about 10 miles or something. So we go down the valley and we go up this steep escarpment into the hills. And up at the top, there's a kind of a shallow depression. And if you had gone there in the first century, you would have found a small community. A few hundred people, perhaps. It's not a particularly significant one. It's It's nowhere mentioned at all in the histories of Josephus, who knew Galilee very well. He's the Jewish historian from the late first century. You might have heard of this village, though. It's called Nazareth. And in this village, we've got a community that's been existing for maybe 100, 150 years at the time I'm talking about here in the first century. What are the origins of this community? We don't really know. It seems archaeologically it had been around for about 100 years or so, and possibly had been formed by people who had moved forward, who had moved north from the area around Jerusalem, perhaps because of all of the political chaos that there was there in the first century BC. Perhaps it's because they wanted to establish a community of people who were really faithful to God. And so they've moved north and they found this safe haven up on the top of this escarpment, and they formed a community. And when they go up out of their little depression where their village is, up onto the top of the ridge, they can look out across the Jezreel Valley and they can see Tabor. They can see the sights of God's deliverance. They can see possibly, if they stand in the right place, off to the west, Carmel, where Elijah defeated the prophets of Baal. And so, let's thought experiment. I don't know whether they ever read Psalm 83 and their gatherings there. But it's interesting to think how that would have resonated for them. Because they hear these references to Jabin and Sisera, to Zeba and Zalmunna, Oreb and Zeb. And they know that if they just pop up the top of the hill, they can see where this happened. This is live history for them when they are thinking about the deliverance of God. One day, the builder's son stands up in the gathering. His name is Yeshua, or you might know him better as Jesus. And he picks up the scroll of Isaiah, and he reads from Isaiah 61. You can read this yourself in Luke chapter 4, 16 to 30. The builder's son, he gets up and he starts to read from Isaiah 61. And he says this: "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Now, this comes from a section of Isaiah which is speaking of God's deliverance. And so what do the people of Nazareth hear? What do they expect? Given their background, given that they can go up the hill and see Tabor, and they hear talk of the deliverance of God, they think, yes, we know what this means. We think this means that the oppressive nations are finally going to be driven out and defeated, and our group is going to be the one that will be at the top of the tree, because they hear this talk of deliverance. They know what that means. This is what they will hear, I think. And they seem to quite like what Jesus says to start with, if you read through Luke 4, 16 to 30. I haven't gotten time to go through that in full now. To start with, they're quite impressed. But then it seems that Jesus sets out to deliberately wind them up, because he draws attention to a couple of stories from the Old Testament which actually rather undermine this picture. I'll just pick on one of them now. The story of Elijah, who helped a widow in Zarephath of Sidon. And Jesus points out, well, you know, there were loads of widows here when that happened. Now, Sidon kind of goes together with Tyre. In Psalm 83, Tyre is mentioned as one of the enemies of God. Tyre and Sidon kind of go together. They're kind of used as a general description of a place. Tyre and Sidon, you know, like Hereford and Worcester, or Dumfries and Galloway, just like Tyre and Sidon, possibly, maybe not. But the point is that he then starts telling them stories of a deliverance of God that goes beyond the boundaries of the sort of deliverance they're looking at, and the sort of deliverance that Psalm 83 might initially have brought to mind for them. And it does their heads in. And so they take him up to the top of the hill. You can see Tabor in the distance, probably, Moreh, and all these other places, desiring to throw him off the hill as someone who has betrayed their kind of hopes. And Jesus walks through the crowd and carries on his way. He carries on his work, his ministry, and of course he ends up on another hill just outside Jerusalem, some 2.5 years later, 3 years later, where he is killed. And yet that then becomes the hill of deliverance. And in the resurrection of Jesus, you see the victory of God. And so when we come back to these kinds of psalms, well, actually, yeah, we can still listen. These psalms have very unfamiliar imagery. There's the martial, military, violent imagery. And that can be hard to cope with. But there's a certain logic here, which I hope you can see, we can still call on. That as we hear a psalm like this, as we look at the ways in which the people of God are under pressure nowadays, in our country in fairly subtle ways, still in other parts of the world, under vicious, violent threat of death, you can look at this psalm and you can see the logic that what you should do when you're under pressure is recall the victories of God in the past. And that can include the victory that is associated with Mount Tabor, but also for us, the victory that is associated with Golgotha, where Jesus said, "It is finished." The victory that is associated with the resurrection of God that says to us that the full cosmic victory has already been won. Even though we do not see that all happening, even though sometimes we may feel that God is silent and you may feel that what you want to express above all with the psalmist is what you see in verse 1. God, why are you silent? And yet we can look into the past and we can see that God has delivered his people. And we can go beyond the psalmist and say that ultimate cosmic deliverance has already begun. Because the resurrection of Jesus is the start of the victory. It's the first fruits of God's final victory. But we live between the times, and we will see victories and we will see defeats. We live like the heroes of Hebrews 11, some of whom through faith conquered kingdoms, some of whom through faith were sawn in two. And that is in many ways the challenge of being a Christian at our stage in the move from creation to non-creation. There is perplexity, but there is hope. And therefore, we can live in the expectation that God's revelation will be made clear. And that final prayer that I'll just finish with from verse 18, let them know that you, whose name is the Lord, that you alone are the most high over all the earth. Amen.